And we're talking about bearing witness in some ways of these hurt places. And I really love the idea, Trevi, of bearing witness and the importance of that. It's an act unto itself that has power.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love for you to describe what that is and how it has power and why it's important for us to not turn our heads away, but to look squarely at it and bear witness.
Yes, thank you. It's connected in a way with the kind of action that we were talking about earlier. I mean, because not all action has to be big action. Not all action has to be about mobilizing and protesting and going out into the streets. In fact, that's super important, but small actions are also important. And along the lines of refusing to disbelieve, which we also talked about a little bit earlier, this idea of bearing witness is a way of saying, I want to face, I am willing to face. I might not want to. I am willing to face what's broken. I am willing to face what's toxic. I am willing to face what's ugly. And that was really part of the essence of Radical Joy for Hard Times, the book I wrote, Radical Joy for Hard Times. It has to do with acknowledging how much we love our places and how much grief we feel when something happens to them. And by bearing witness, we simply are willing to go and face what's happening. It seems like a very small thing. Just to simply go and look and listen and face it. And yet it's something that a lot of people avoid because they are afraid that if they do go and face a place that they love that's been hurt, and it doesn't necessarily need to be in the natural world. It could be like a street corner in St. Louis where a young boy was murdered by a white police, a young black boy was murdered by a white policeman. You know, it could be a place where there was a car crash and people lost their lives. Any kind of wounded place, there's this sense of if I go there, I'll be overwhelmed with grief. And yet that's really not what happens. There may be probably the sense of reluctance is stronger before we actually go than when we get there. And I have found in my life that this work of going to hurt places and facing them, even if I don't do anything else, it enables me to face other hard times in my life. So I think that story I told about hearing the katydids right after my husband died, I think that part of my ability to do that was because I've been going to wounded places all these years and not wanting to walk away from them. Even if I didn't want to face something, knowing I need to face this, I need to bear witness to this, whatever it is, it makes us more open to both the sorrow of the world, but also the beauty of the world.
I'm reminded of, as you were speaking about that, of driving where I was driving, route that I drive often. And one day there was a bicycle that appeared right there at the stoplight. And it was decorated with flowers all over it. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, oh, someone died here. Someone died here. And then someone took the time to just honor it. And then we all could feel that. Even as I describe it, I feel that death of someone I didn't even know, but I can feel it in my heart.
Yeah.
Even in this moment, it's quite amazing when we do acknowledge that in talking about how different teachers appear to us. In that case, if the teacher was somebody took the time to acknowledge it, that's a teacher for me. But you, I think you describe something that happened for you that became a teacher. And it was when you were getting on a subway car and something happened. Do you recall that particular story?
Yes. It was when I was living in New York City. And I was in a subway station one morning, very crowded. It was rush hour. And everybody was positioned to push onto the train when it came. And there was a man, probably homeless, you know, kind of pretty scruffy looking, not very well kempt, you know, scraggly hair. He was leaning against a wall, and then very gradually he kind of sank down the wall until he was sitting on the floor, the dirty floor. And I noticed this. A few other people noticed it probably, but nobody did anything, except there was one young woman, quite young, like she might have been going to her first job, she might have been in college, and she actually walked over to this man, put her hand on his shoulder, leaned over, and asked if she could help. And nobody else in that entire crowded subway platform paid any attention, but this one young person did. You know, what she probably had someplace to get to. They probably were expecting her to be there on time, but she saw this as being more important. And I still think of that because she so inspired me. She inspired me to pay attention to what's needed that I might be able to do, even though I might think I have something more important to do. It was really, really touching. She was a teacher to me.
So in that way, you didn't act in the moment, but it resonated with you. It changed you in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't act in the moment. And afterwards, I said to myself, why didn't I do that? Was I in so much of a hurry that getting somewhere on time was more important than going to see to somebody who was obviously in need of help? But that young woman did. And she changed my trajectory in life to being more aware of when I might step in and help somebody.
Right. And how we can be just stopped in our tracks, hopefully. I mean, not always, because we're so rushing, as you say, all the people I see, the platform and the subway station, and everybody's just really busy wanting to crowd into the next car and get on and with their life. And we don't stop to hear that person playing the violin. And I remember there was somebody who's very, yeah, very famous violinist that was playing in a subway station, and people would just walk on by.
Joshua Bell in Washington in the Metro. Yeah, I love that story.
I love that story. So, or you tell a wonderful story. I just love the visual of this. This was during the pandemic when the seagulls going past the firehouse.
Yeah, that was great. That was the first month or so of the pandemic. And I was having a meeting with people on Zoom. And all of a sudden, this man who was living in New York City says, oh, my God, wait a minute. So he got up from his chair and he disappeared. And we had no idea what was going on. And then he came back and he said, I can't believe what just happened. A flock of seagulls just flew down 49th Street and they turned right at the corner and flew past the firehouse. And I used to live in New York City, so I could picture this. And he said, all the firemen came out to watch. So it was like, I think that chapter is Let Beauty Seduce You. I think that was the chapter that it's in. I picked really kind of quirky titles for these chapters. That he could have just sat there, and he was talking about fundraising. You know, he could have just said to himself, well, I'm here. I'm talking about an important topic. I can't be distracted by seagulls. But he let himself be distracted by seagulls. And then he noticed that the firefighters were also attracted by seagulls, flying together down streets that were unusually empty because people weren't out because there was so much really bad COVID in New York City. And they just took time to get swept away by a bunch of seagulls going down the street in the wrong direction, I might add.
What that says to me is you talk about standing still for the beauty. And I was talking to our engineer, Lou Judson, just before we started this interview. And Lou does a lot of recording of live music. And we were talking about what the beauty of live music and how after I'm at some sort of concert, I want to hold on to it. So I buy a souvenir CD and I bring it home and then I put it on. And Trevi, the magic isn't there. And I think you describe it. You can't bring home a souvenir of beauty. Tell us about that.
Yeah. And I so identify with what you just said. I've done that so many times at concerts. And then but I've never quite thought about it in that way. It's like it doesn't have the magic, but it's really true. I was thinking about people who take photographs of wonderful things. And taking photographs of wonderful things is fine, of course. But what I have specifically noticed in several places that I've been to is people will walk up to something that's wonderful. Like particularly, I was thinking about Strasbourg Cathedral in France. And people would walk up and take a picture and move on. It's like they wouldn't even look at this frieze or these statues. They would simply recognize that it was worth looking at and take a picture and move on. And I mean, I think your story about the concert is such a great example, because looking at a photograph is such a poor substitute for actually standing in front of that frieze, which I was doing. I mean, I spent a couple of days in Strasbourg and I would just stand in front of these beautiful sculptures and look and look and look. And I felt badly for the people who are only taking pictures of them and thinking that they might see them later. It's no comparison.
Exactly. And this has to do, because the whole trajectory of what we're talking about is to help us in our grief. I mean, it's related. You talk about joy and grief are two sides of a coin.
Yes. And I think personally, I think being open to beauty is a lifesaver. I think it can help us get through anything in life, whether it's personal grief, worry, fear, climate change, political upset. And what I've begun to realize is it's not that we can't always find beauty in the situation. I mean, you can't, for example, look at if your home's been destroyed by a wildfire, you can't simply stand there and go, well, where's the beauty here? But the beauty might be come a day later or a week later when you see green shoots pushing up through the char. Or it might be somebody coming by with a generous act.
Yes, I want you to say more about that in just one moment, but I want to remind our listeners, I'm here with Trevi Johnson, and she is the author of Fierce Consciousness, Surviving the Sorrows of Earth and Self. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Trevi Johnson, and we're talking about beauty. And you just made a statement, beauty is a lifesaver. And that's such a powerful statement. And I'd like for you to elaborate more on that.
Yes. So as I was saying, we can't necessarily always find beauty in the situation itself. You know, like that moment I described with walking out of the hospice. At that moment, there was no beauty in the fact that my husband had just died, my husband of 34 years. But then there were those katydids, which were completely unexpected, which brought that, it was like a dart of beauty into my heart and life. So it's not about looking at a bad situation and saying, well, okay, I need to find some beauty in this. It's being open to where the beauty otherwise might be. It's really important not just to be open to receiving beauty, but to give it, and in small ways. And, you know, like, for example, when I was in that hospice with my husband before he died, I was very grateful for the attention that the nurses were giving him. They were just so kind. They didn't condescend. And I thanked them for it. You know, I appreciated it in the moment and I thanked them for it. And another story I love was about I think I told this in Radical Joy for Hard Times, I'm not sure, a family whose neighborhood had burned down near Santa Rosa, California. And they went back up there around Christmas time. I think the fire had been in the fall. They went back up there at Christmas time and they brought a Christmas tree and they put it in their front yard, or what had been their front yard. Their home was completely gone, and decorated it with battery-powered Christmas lights. And that inspired their neighbors to come and do the same thing. I mean, they made beauty in a hurt place. And newspapers caught on to it, and television stations. And it was an act of outrageous courage and creativity and community and spontaneity. That it was like those katydids. It was like saying, we're down and out. We haven't got a home. We don't know where we're going to live next. But damn, we can make beauty. We can go back to our place and we can make beauty. And there is, and so the leap between making Christmas tree decorations at your burned neighborhood and thanking a nurse when you're at, you know, when you're seeing your husband's last hours is a big leap. And yet it's, in my opinion, it's both a way of saying, you know, there are other people in the world. There are other animals in the world. There's life. There are possibilities. And what can I do to put a little beauty into the world, even as I'm receiving beauty?
And what you're describing in the Christmas tree, that was an audacious act.
It was audacious.
My community, because I live in Santa Rosa, I'm right here. I live here. And that happened right here where I live. Oh. It brought us together as a community. And I'm thinking of another example of that. And that was in midst of the COVID, when we're all sheltering in place, and how people got out on their balconies, like at a certain time, like 7 o'clock at night, every day, and they would bang pots and pans, and they would just cheer on all the healthcare and all the workers who, you know, giving back to them an acknowledgement. And that happened worldwide. And
it did, yeah.
I think the point of it is, this is where, when we go back to the very beginning of this interview, we hold our grief and our acknowledgments and the truth of where we are and what's happening together as a community. And that in itself is assuaging our powerlessness.
Yeah, and we know we're not alone.
We know we're not alone. And that's an important act. So if somebody is audacious enough to put a Christmas tree, what that did, it's like putting a pebble in a pond, and it's just expanding those rings of little waves that it makes, and it expands out, and it becomes very inclusive. We embrace one another. It's an act of community, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and one act inspires another. You know, it's people people didn't only go up and look at the Christmas tree that the first family had put there. They added to it. They put their own Christmas trees. Somebody put a note to Santa Claus on their mailbox on a board telling them where their temporary address was. You know, so it was, it filled people with a kind of, I think, joy, a sense that, oh, we're not powerless after all. We've perhaps lost everything. And yet we can do this kind of fanciful, weird, wild, crazy, creative thing.
Exactly. Exactly. And so here's where you talk about we all at this point in our trajectory as a global community, we all need to understand and tune into our own superpower. And maybe it's something just so innate in us that we don't even notice what it is. And so what advice do you have that tuning into our superpower is really important in these times?
I had a young friend who introduced this concept to me, and he would go around and ask people what their superpower was. And so I started doing it. And I did it a lot when I was on this crazy book tour that I did in March and April. And usually when you ask people what their superpower is, they think for a while, and then they want to be very modest about it. And my friend, whose name was Noah Crow, he wanted you to be outrageous with your superpower. So the point I make in the book was, where would Wonder Woman be if she only said, I'm pretty good in an emergency, you know, like we have to be bold. We have to be able to say outrageous things about ourselves. And there are things we're just really good at. Like, you know, I connect two people who desperately need to know each other and had no idea of that or something. I mean, that's not mine. I just made it up. And by knowing that, we kind of assign ourselves a role in life that in a bigger way than we might ordinarily have recognized. We say, okay, this is what I can do. This is how I contribute to life. And by making it big, we turn ourselves into a superhero in a sense. Not that we're going to go around and expect people to do things for us or punch through walls, but to act in a way that we and we alone are capable of acting.
I love that, because if we do look at who we are and what is natural to us that we're already doing, and then be conscious of it, then we know that is what we can contribute to the betterment of all the life around us. And this also reminds me, I think I wrote this down from your book because I thought it was such a good idea, about when we get with people, instead of asking them, okay, what is it you do? You know, what is your work in the world? But to ask them, what is it? I'm just thinking in my own women's circle, I know what they do in the world. And if I help go deeper in understanding them and they understanding themselves, if I ask them the question, what do you love about what you do?
Yeah.
And that's a very different question than what is it you do?
Yeah.
How did you come up with that one?
I don't remember exactly how I came up with it, but I think I might have come up with it when I was I had a dent in my car when I lived in Pennsylvania, and I had to take it to a guy to get the dent taken out. And while he was working on the car, his wife was doing taking all the parts out of a little Volkswagen. And I started having a conversation with her, and she was not very forthcoming. You know, she would answer in one or two words, and I didn't have anything else to do. And I just the very fact that she was so sort of terse about it, not forthcoming, made me really want to know why she loved what she did. So I kind of kept asking her these questions in different ways. And she finally said, well, you know, I really love that I can take all the parts out of this little car and put them on a blanket on the grass and you can see everything. And then one at a time, I put them back in. And so I realized that in any conversation with anybody, you know, whether it's a good friend or somebody I've never met or somebody that I assume I have absolutely nothing in common with, if you get them talking about why they love what they do, something opens up, some like a realness, an authenticity, a beauty, a genuineness opens up. And it works. I mean, I've never had it not work.
Oh, wonderful. I want to thank you so much, Treppy, for being with us today. It's just been marvelous to be with you. I've been speaking with Treppy Johnson. She's the author of Fierce Consciousness, Surviving the Sorrows of Earth and Self. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, TreppyJohnson.com. And she spells her first name, Treppy, T-R-E-B, as in boy, T-R-E-B-B-E, Johnson.com, TreppyJohnson.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3799.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org, or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support, and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Duane Elgin, author of Choosing Earth. And next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about our collective journey through breakdown to a mature planetary community.
At Inspire, we know a lot about Indigenous success. It's what we build together each and every day. We're one of Canada's leading nonprofits. Not only do we help erase the financial burden of post-secondary education costs for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit students across Turtle Island, we also provide access to future career and education prospects for Indigenous students through our Rivers to Success mentorship program. It's free to join. Register today for monthly events happening across Turtle Island. You'll get the latest information about your future post-secondary and career options. Register online now at riverstosuccess.ca. Again, that's riverstosuccess.ca. Register today. Prizes, information, and fun are waiting.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
You're listening to CJSF.